This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett.
Almost 6 years ago, a scandal rocked the car industry.
The world's biggest car manufacturer, and maybe the biggest ever corporate scandal.
Germany's largest company, Volkswagen, admitted cheating emissions tests in the US.
If you're a VW shareholder or employee today, the letters stand for very worried.
VW fitted so-called defeat devices in 11 million diesel-powered cars worldwide.
There are still drivers who don't know if their VW car was rigged to cheat pollution targets.
We are very sorry to have broken your trust. I think what they meant is we're very sorry to have lied to you.
The software detected when cars were being tested for compliance with emission rules. The software then adjusted the engines so they passed. But in normal use, they emitted far more pollution, including up to 40 times more nitrogen oxide, which contributes to asthma, bronchitis, and emphysema.
Unlike the banking scandals of recent years, this one isn't measured in money.
Nitrogen dioxide causes asthma, it causes strokes, it causes birth abnormalities, it causes people to die earlier than they should do. And Volkswagen took a decision to fit technology and software to their vehicle, knowing that their cars will produce much more.
The environmental and human cost could be devastating. The financial cost to the company and investors will be tough too. According to a report on the Fortune website back in October 2020, Volkswagen took a $7.3 billion charge to its earnings days after the scandal broke. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. $42.5 billion got wiped off the company's share price, or 46% of its value, in the 2 months following the scandal. It took nearly 5 years for the share price to recover. That's not to mention the loss of jobs and the cost to its reputation. But the scandal affected more than just VW.
This scandal, though, certainly not good news for auto suppliers that do business with Volkswagen.
It's not just Volkswagen. There are other manufacturers that must have been doing something similar.
According to a report in the Guardian newspaper, in Germany, testers found all but three of 53 car models exceeded nitrous oxide limits. In London, more than 97% of more than 250 models were in violation. Class action lawsuits have since been launched against Daimler, Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, Renault, Nissan and Vauxhall by numerous firms in the UK. The scandal has not only exposed the flagrant disregard of the rules by the car manufacturers themselves, but also the weakness of the institutions responsible for enforcing them. And there are concerns that the real estate sector could be exposed to something similar in the future.
You know, the car industry, the oil industry has really kept the real estate sector off the front pages.
That's Tom Walker, co-head of global real estate at Schroders. And he's concerned that the impact could be even bigger than the car emissions scandal.
Whichever way you cut it, it really is a significant polluter.
So in today's show, we're going to discuss how the real estate sector might avoid an emission scandal and what the sector will look like in a post-COVID world. But in part one, we'll discuss whether the real estate sector is sleepwalking into an emission scandal.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So I think most people will look at what's happened at Volkswagen and within the car industry and probably have a clearer understanding about the amount of fumes that are chucked out of an exhaust in relation to its impacts on the environment. But perhaps with real estate, it's not quite so clear. So Tom, first of all, can you just give us an idea of what the carbon footprint is for the real estate industry?
Really, when you look at the contribution that the real estate sector makes to greenhouse gases, it's really very significant. So according to the United Nations, real estate contributes about 30%, that's 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions globally, and it consumes about 40% of the world's energy. And if we bring it back to sort of slightly more kind of, you know, us here in Europe, within Europe, about a third of all emissions are from the real estate sector in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And then in the UK, about 20% of our greenhouse gas emissions are from the real estate sector. So you can see whichever way you cut it, it really is a significant polluter.
What goes into generating those carbon emissions? I presume it's across the whole supply chain, is it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is across the whole supply chain. Really, you know, the key, I suppose, operational emission is with regard to both the heating of a building and the cooling of a building. And if you think about, you know, many of the assets or real estate assets situated in very hot cities or very cold cities, that's really where you're going to see significant emissions, you know, coming out if the assets are not constructed in a very efficient manner. And then, of course, you also have emissions in the construction of assets as well, you know, concrete and steel being the main ingredients in a building. And those raw materials have significant emissions as well in their construction.
So while the VW and the car industry emissions scandal focus more on the vehicle's emissions, for the real estate sector, we're talking more about the entire production chain.
Yeah, exactly. It's important to look at this in a holistic manner.
Okay, so what have the notorious VW emissions scandal got to do with the real estate sector?
Yeah, I just thought that's quite an interesting analogy in that with the VW scandal, you had a company, if you like, policing itself with these kind of emission testers that they put into the vehicles. And, you know, the emission tester came up with the magical answer of saying, you know, this is a very green car, and it allowed VW to have some green bragging rights, if you can call it that. And I just think that when I look at the real estate sector itself is coming up with a number of what's called really green certificates for buildings. In effect, they are policing themselves and they're saying, look, you know, my building is better than another. It's got net zero carbon. And whilst that may be true for a number of buildings and a number of the certificates may be, you know, completely accurate, I think that globally there is no industry standard. And I think that there is some pretty loose terminology in a lot of these certificates that people have that then use to claim those green bragging rights. So we cannot afford to sort of spin our way out of trouble with just, you know, loose terminology and claiming to be green. We really need something very serious. Just as the car industry did and now has, we need that to happen in the real estate sector.
So in effect, this sounds like it could be a lot bigger than the car industry scandal if it was ever to come to fruition.
Yeah, I think there is potential for a lot of people to, you know, to have accusations made at them to say, look, you know, is this really a green building? Have you looked at the, you know, entire kind of supply chain of the materials that you're using? And I think that that is something that we need to look at very carefully.
Now, from what I understand, with the VW emissions scandal, there were central government agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency in the US, that were supposed to be monitoring these emissions from cars. Is there anything similar within the building industry or the real estate sector?
There's nothing that is uniform. I think what you're beginning to see is particular countries and actually even particular cities enforcing their own regulation. So we're seeing in Germany now, you've got a carbon tax that is going to impact, you know, owners of real estate because, you know, they are going to be, you know, using fossil fuels to heat or cool the building. That's now going to cost them money. So there is a very clear path of direction in Germany. Similarly, if we look at a city like New York, by 2050, they want to have all of their buildings with net zero carbon. And so you're seeing geographies move at different speeds. But as I mentioned earlier, there is no kind of global standard that people are moving towards.
And that also sounds a little bit like double standards. So companies might want to develop in certain areas of the world where perhaps the regulations are slightly more lax. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think that is fair. And I think that, you know, one of the innate conflicts that, you know, a sector has, you know, the car industry wants to create more cars to sell, to create more profit. The real estate sector is no different. You know, innate in this industry is people want to develop, they want to create new buildings, and, you know, lease them out to people so that they can create more profit. And I think that, you know, there is a conflict there. You know, is that new building necessary? Do we need another office built, or do we just need existing offices retrofitted in an environmentally friendly way?
Okay, so it does sound like there is an issue there for the real estate sector. So in part two, we're going to look at why the sector's green credentials are problematic and whether it can avoid a scandal.
Get in touch with us by email at shorterspodcasts@shorters.com or visit our website, shorters.com/investor download.
So we touched on a few of the issues in the first part of the show there, Tom. Can you just tell us why the sector's green credentials are problematic?
Yeah, I think it really boils down to this definition of, you know, a developer or somebody who owns a building saying, you know, my building is net zero carbon. And if you think about it very logically, it's almost nonsensical that somebody can make that claim, because it completely overlooks, you know, the environmental impact that has been caused in the construction of that building. You know, I mentioned earlier, you know, one of the main ingredients in any new development, you know, today is concrete and steel. And you look at the greenhouse gas emissions that are created when those raw materials are created for buildings and then subsequently used. So I think that to claim a building is net zero carbon, it may be right from an operational point of view, but it's not going to be right from a holistic point of view. And so therein lies the conflict. It's kind of using some terminology which suits one part of the argument without looking across the whole supply chain.
And who carries the financial load to making sure these buildings are truly net carbon?
Yeah, there's no one answer to that. It really will just depend on, you know, somebody like Schroders, for instance, could decide, right, we want a new corporate headquarters. They could then go and approach a developer and work, if you like, hand in glove with that developer to create a net zero carbon building, ensuring that at every step, the environmental impact was minimized. But many businesses probably won't have the ability or, I suppose, kind of a confidence to be able to do that. And they may just suddenly decide, right, you know, they wake up tomorrow and say, right, we need new premises. We're going to go and find what's available. And so they don't allow themselves to have that partnership with the developer. So they are then going to be, you know, a recipient of whatever is available in the market. What is clear today is that the leading developers globally, they are all developing their buildings to net zero carbon. They are all trying to minimize their environmental impact. So we do see a very clear trend of those assets which are developed in the most superior way, i.e. the minimal impact on the environment, they are signing leases quicker. They are going to have a more resilient income stream. So it's a key part of the analysis that we carry out. But it is very important to understand, yeah, which assets are enabling that transition to net zero and which are going to be very, very slow with regard to that journey.
And how can buildings truly get to net carbon zero?
It is about looking across the whole supply chain. You know, we're aware of, you know, a number of developers over in Scandinavia, for instance, who are looking to recycle materials from, you know, if you like, older buildings that have already been constructed, recycle those materials. So instead of, you know, if you like, mandating people to give them new steel or new concrete, they are recycling those existing raw materials, which will enable that construction of the building to be, you know, as close to net zero carbon as possible. And then on the operational side of the building, you know, they will be ensuring that the energy, the water usage is all very efficiently used, therefore minimizing that environmental and greenhouse gas emissions. So it is possible, but it is something that the sector is moving to slowly. You know, if you think about kind of the number of buildings that are, you know, there in every city, every country, and there's a lot of old buildings there. So it is going to be a slow process.
And is there as much pressure on the real estate sector as the automakers as getting towards net zero?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And again, I referenced earlier the legislation in Germany, and I would argue that somewhere like Germany, and I'd also mentioned Scandinavia earlier, there are some geographies which maybe they have bolder politicians, or it's just in their culture. And I think Scandinavia has consistently been one of the world leaders with regard to kind of, you know, net zero carbon. So we see far more aggressive policies in that part of the world. Here in the UK, as much as it's been in the press and people are aware of it, the government has actually sort of shied away from really enforcing kind of the legislation that we need to really transition to net zero carbon very quickly. You know, a few years ago, they missed an opportunity. They were speaking about the legislation to really enforce all new homes that were built to be built to a specific standard. In the end, they didn't commit to that, which was a real shame. So again, there's no one answer to that. It depends where you are and depends on what your government's attitude is to the greenhouse gas emission story.
Okay, so can the real estate sector prevent itself from sleepwalking into its own emission scandal?
I'm not sure about the answer for that question. I think that in particular countries, I think that there will not be a scandal. You know, I mentioned, you know, whether it's Scandinavia, whether it's perhaps Australia, you know, the Netherlands, you know, some cities in the US like New York, they are very ambitious. And I cannot see any scandals, you know, kind of coming from those locations. Other parts of the world are slower. And I think it's really a question of, you know, when the politicians wake up and understand that they'd be very slow to react to, as we mentioned, you know, a sector that contributes to 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And it's something that we can all relate to. We all live in shelter. We all, you know, go to work in an asset of some sort, spend our leisure time in one. So it's something that is very real for all of us. So, you know, there is a chance that in, you know, by countries leaving it too late, there could still be a scandal that kind of catches everybody, I think.
Okay, so a potential emissions scandal seems like another obstacle for the real estate sector and its investors to navigate as we make our way out of the pandemic. So in the final part of the show, we're going to focus on global cities, home to millions of people, workers, and some of the world's most famous real estate. We'll discuss whether they can survive or perhaps even thrive as the COVID crisis recedes. So before the coronavirus pandemic, 17% of US employees work from home 5 days a week or more, a share that increased to 44% during the pandemic. That's according to the website Statista.com. The London Assembly governmental body found 4.5% of the 450 Londoners it polled, and that would be the equivalent of 416,000 city dwellers, said they would definitely move out of the city within the next 12 months. That was late in 2020. We're now 18 months into the pandemic. So, Tom, what are the trends that we're seeing developing in terms of global cities and specifically people returning or perhaps not returning to cities?
Yeah, I mean, you referenced there, you know, people kind of polling saying that they wanted to move out of a city. And it has been very interesting. I mean, if we look at the data we can now see, and we take New York as an example, we can see that those people who have actually moved, you know, from the center of a city, and I use that word center very specifically, they've actually only moving to the suburbs of New York. And I think that tells us a really interesting story. I think that tells us that, look, people are not prepared to actually really move far out because they still realize that the city is going to be very important to us. I think also what the headlines focus on is those people moving out or to the suburbs. They're not focusing actually on the more on people moving into the city. And there is still very strong demand, you know, for people to live in a city. I think really what one of the trends that we're seeing is that the city is potentially going to become younger. You know, we've just seen, again, using New York as an example, we've just seen this last month a sixfold increase in the number of leases signed on apartments in Manhattan. That is the most sort of number of leases signed in a month since 2009. So, you know, it's really, there is clearly a price when it gets to such an attractive point that people are saying, no, I want to be in a city. That's fine. And I think that's quite interesting for us. So I would say one of the trends is that, you know, potentially cities get younger. And actually for a city, that would be a very positive thing because, you know, young people are generally dynamic, they're open-minded, more entrepreneurial. So that could be a real kind of fuel for economic growth in a city. Outside of that, the trends that we're seeing are really quite geographic. If you look over in Asia, cities like Shanghai, Beijing, you know, Hong Kong, they've really been back doing face-to-face meetings, having conferences for a very long time. And I think it's really all to do with looking at how the government of that particular country dealt with the pandemic. So you can contrast, if you like, the success of certain Asian countries with potentially the failure of some European countries like the UK as an example. And so the hesitancy that we have here in the UK and in other countries across Europe to go back to the office, back to the city, I think is really more a mark as to how the government have dealt with it as opposed to anything else. And so there is no uniform, you know, all cities are back or all cities are, you know, very quiet. It really is very mixed around the world, and we're seeing it change pretty rapidly. You know, we're seeing a pretty successful rollout of vaccines, obviously, in the States. So their kind of cities are getting back to normal, and the hesitancy to work from home is less than potentially what we're seeing here in Europe, in the UK and Western Europe.
I mean, this is the first time, certainly in modern history, that the Western world has been forced to come to terms with a health crisis of this magnitude. But are there any lessons that we can learn from the past in how these health crises have affected the development of cities?
Yeah, I mean, we can look in the kind of the recent past, and you look again over to Asia, where you've had, you know, bird flu or swine flu. You know, again, they kind of had experienced pandemics before. And in, you know, in every example, all the major cities in Asia have continued to grow larger, become more efficient, and levels of urbanization have continued to grow, you know, very significantly. So you can see that, you know, a recent health pandemic has not impacted those cities. If you go further back in history, you can look at kind of the cholera outbreaks of the 1800s, which led to the kind of creation of sewers and modern sanitation. You can go back to the Great Fire of London, which led to the creation of, you know, fireproof bricks. And so I think the way we think about a crisis and a city is that all that happens is it just hastens that inevitable change. So again, working from home, e-commerce, these things are not new. They've been in the market for a long period of time. All that the pandemic has done is it means that the take-up of working from home, the take-up of e-commerce has just grown incredibly rapidly, arguably 5 to 10 years worth of, you know, growth taking place in sort of a 12-month period. And that's how we see it. So, you know, we don't see any threat for cities. It's just particular subsectors in cities, I think, will be challenged, like offices, like retail.
Yeah, so it does sound like you still seem optimistic about cities. I just want, final question, what changes do you anticipate we might see as the pandemic recedes?
Yeah, I think people are, you know, looking carefully at their commutes. You know, do you need to be in the office 5 days a week, or can you come in and network and collaborate and collude with your colleagues on maybe 2 or 3 days? And so, you know, that is certainly a trend that we expect. But again, it's going to occur more in those cities where people have longer commute times. And I think, you know, again, I would sort of highlight Europe and the US as kind of being kind of more impacted by working from home than certain cities like Hong Kong or Singapore, where if you think about the average accommodation size that people live in or the average commute time, the apartment is a lot smaller, the commute time is a lot shorter. So that working from home demand will be less. So I think that, you know, we expect working from home to impact office demand in certain cities. You know, it's very clear how important digital infrastructure is across cities to keep us all connected, whether we're working from home or in the office. And again, as I highlighted earlier, I think kind of the idea that cities could become younger is actually a very exciting prospect for us, because, you know, we know young people are entrepreneurial. We know that they bring a lot of vibrancy to a city. So, you know, and I think that, again, when you step back to why cities have been so important over such a long period of time, it's the efficiencies that you can derive from so many people being clustered together. And we expect that to continue, that clustering of expertise in particular fields, in particular cities around the world, I think will continue to provide a very strong outlook for cities around the world.
So far from the obituary that might have been written maybe a year ago for cities at the start of the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we think that cities have seen these crises before. It will just change the way cities are used. But that efficiency, that agglomeration benefit that you get, the network effect, it's hard to see anything that can rival that.
Yeah, just need to avoid a emissions scandal at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's what else investors are talking about. Right now, equity valuations suggest it's time to slow down in markets. But you can't take your foot too far off the gas due to the dearth of more defensive options. It's a predicament that reminds Johanna Kirkland of the 1994 blockbuster movie Speed. In speed, a bus must keep above 50 miles per hour. If the speedometer dips below that level, the bus will explode. While investors are not facing a literal fireball, those who drive too cautiously might be figuratively setting fire to potential investment returns. You can read Chief Investment Officer Johanna Kirkland's article, Time to Slow Down, But Not Too Much, at schroders.com/insights, where you can find much, much more. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything on the show or give us ideas for future shows, you can email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. If you want to listen to the Investor Downloads back catalogue, and why wouldn't you? You can go to schroders.com/the Investor Download or rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every other Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.